Hi, my coworkers and I were having a conversation today about local car commercials, and we're wondering, why are they all so bad?
Hey, Jamie.
Hey, Flora.
All right, you called about bad local car ads. I'm pretty sure I know what you mean, but could you give me an impression just to make sure?
Cars, cars, cars. They're here. We're pet friendly. Buy a car.
Okay, I brought some case studies, and I'm hoping we can analyze them and pick out their essential ingredients.
Okay.
Rob White here from Ultimate Image Auto. Let's talk turkey.
Male spokesperson.
Yes, historically car salesmen were mostly men, and they still are today.
This is what I mean. Here's a belly, unstuff. Here's a belly, stuff. Unstuff.
He's like actually showing a big belly and then a smaller belly. Big belly, smaller belly.
I need my lot stuff. Get up to 5,000.
And then there also are always deals.
You want centuries?
I got centuries. $99 a century. Come on down to Racklandisa. Our prices are insane.
And often there's this sort of self-proclaimed craziness.
Yes.
Welcome back to the Crazy Greek Show with me, Seamus, the Crazy Greek. Our
prices are what so made you so crazy? Did you snap? What happened?
Crazy! Look who got me on Monday, starting as low as $69 a month! Opa!
Did he yell Opa?
He sure did. Also, just a note, ideally I'd like to avoid the word crazy, but these car dealers use it a lot, so it's gonna pop up.
Yes.
And whatever we call it, this zany, over-the-top personality madman is weirdly consistent across these ads.
Yeah. So was there like one person that was like, I'm going to make this commercial and everyone is going to make commercials after me that are just like this?
That would be wild.
I mean, was there?
Yes, there is.
Madman.
There's a locus classicus.
That's Stephen Gelber, a lover of Latin.
Now, he wasn't sui generis, but there's an actual specific person who created this form of on-air hysteria, the originator of the crazy used car ad.
From Madman Mutz.
One person.
One person.
Yes, the crazy used car ad goes back to one innovator. And Stephen is the perfect person to tell us about him.
Well, I am a used car salesman expert historian.
And if you were to look in a used car salesman expert history textbook, before the crazy used car ads, you'd find the emergence of the sleazy used car dealer.
Okay.
You know the stereotype.
Transmission. The sawdust quiets the gears and lets the engine run as sweet as a nut for a couple of miles.
Daddy, that's cheating.
Of course it's cheating. Nobody ever got rich being honest. 20
but
years
where
ago,
did that caricature come from? Because it didn't start like that. In the beginning, car dealers had a good reputation. They were considered knowledgeable and trustworthy.
Yes, there was a moment, a prelapsarian moment.
Just in case, the word prelapsarian means the biblical time before the fall of man. So this is BS, before sleazeball.
An Edenic moment when car salesmen were actually what car salesmen wanted to be.
The fall from grace is coming. In 1908, the Model T comes on the market. It's mass-produced, and the price of cars drops.
A car becomes available to the middle class. It's no longer a luxury item.
By the 1920s, those first new Model Ts are now used Model Ts. And from the dealership perspective, this is a problem. They call it the used car problem.
There were a sufficient number of used cars that people had to be induced to buy new cars.
Dealerships start offering trade-ins. They buy back used cars. And the used car salesman is born.
They were, from the very beginning, considered the sleaziest, the least honest, the bottom of the automobile business.
And that's because there's no set price for a used car. That means you have to haggle with the used car dealer, and you could potentially be cheated because it's hard to know how much a used car is worth.
I mean, you don't know where that thing's been. It could have literally been driven off a cliff and then reassembled.
So used car dealers became notorious for coming up with tricks to hide the car's faults.
For a while, it was even legal to roll back the speedometer or the odometer, so long as you rolled it back to zero.
By the 1920s, we have left the parking lot of Eden. Used car dealers saw that juicy apple of customer confusion and vulnerability and took a big old bite.
The bad reputation then of car dealers begins to take deep root in the 1920s.
So the checkered suit, the slick talker, the odometer roller backer, that character dates back 100 years.
Absolutely, 100 years.
I think we can safely say that for most salespeople, that sleazy reputation would be an obstacle, a minus. But one used car dealer seemed to find inspiration in it.
Madman, 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 madman.
The Locus Classicus, the originator of the crazy used car ad, is Earl Muntz, better known as Madman Muntz.
Is that like his God-given name, Madman?
No, it's his self-given name. And here's his deal. Muntz is a used car dealer in California in the 1940s. He has this idea to buy cars for cheap in the Midwest and then sell them in California for a profit.
He's not at all concerned with wealth.
And he teams up with this advertising mogul, Michael Shore. And it is these two who develop the Madman persona.
The madmen behind the madmen.
Psychiatrists have given up.
And this wasn't an obvious advertising move. Like, no one else was doing this at the time.
You have to distinguish yourself. You go the opposite. They zig, you zag.
That's media historian Martin Gastanian. And the idea is that rather than running away from the terrible used car salesman persona, run towards it.
And so Shore thought, you're eccentric. You're wild. You're a madman. Earl had a very, very larger-than-life personality, so that type of eccentricity appealed to him, I am sure.
Muntz and Michael Shore devise a logo. The studio that draws Bugs Bunny draws it up, and it's Muntz as Napoleon.
It always been, one of the cliches that if you were crazy, you thought you were Napoleon. That seemed to be the most iconic bit of crazy that you could assume the guise of if you were thought to be legally insane.
Jamie, are you by a computer? I want you to look at this logo.
I can look on my phone. Oh, there he is.
So it's a drawing of Muntz as Napoleon wearing classic Napoleon outfit, like the hat and boots, but also he's strangely in red PJs.
Yeah, I was thinking that that looked a little bit like a onesie.
If you're listening right now and you want to see the logo, go to elt.show/Napoleon-in-a-onesie. Muntz also plays the madman himself sometimes. If you Google Madman Muntz, he pops up.
Madman Muntz. I see him next to a billboard. I want to give him away, but Mrs. Muntz won't let me. She's crazy.
I found that ad very confusing.
Well, that's not a way to talk about your wife.
Also, it's like, you're crazy.
Yeah, like your name is literally Madman.
Yeah.
There's a lot of really good photos of him.
His mouth could contort into, an exceptionally wide grin. It looks as if he's, an astronaut going through about maybe 3 or 4 G's worth of force.
He does look like he's trapped in a wind tunnel. But it's also like you can tell he's not actually a madman. It's like what you would imagine a madman to be.
It's like a caricature of a madman.
Yeah. It's like, I kind of want to know what he was like in real life.
Well, I can tell you. In real life, he's fascinating. He patents a design for an early TV. He also names his daughter TV, T-E-E-V-E-E. He invents the 4-track cassette, which goes on to inspire the 8-track. And his inventing method is kind of brilliant. He takes a pre-existing product, removes as many parts as he can before the thing stops working to make the cheapest version of that thing. And this method comes to be known as Muntzing.
Which is his name plus ing. He was known for keeping a pair of nippers with him. And the idea was that he kept on trying to prune away what he felt were the non-essential portions of the componentry. In this case, the television. If the television set went dark, he said, well, I guess we have to keep that one in.
He's kind of a disinventor. And in his time, He's also kind of a pop icon. Like, Bob Hope makes fun of him.
I had a little trouble getting here. Madman Munch chased me for 3 blocks, ladies and gentlemen.
The Three Stooges make fun of him.
You can't buy a chariot for half the money over in Madman Ramesses.
His used car lot becomes an attraction on Hollywood tours.
The thing is, like, I don't think I would want to trust a person like that.
I know. So here's Stephen Gelber's theory on why the madman shtick might sell cars.
The whole thing is to create a circus atmosphere, an atmosphere of excitement, an atmosphere of unsureness.
An atmosphere where you might be able to catch a break. So even though you don't have the upper hand, negotiation-wise, because you don't know the history of the car, maybe with this madman selling the car to you, you'll have an advantage.
Maybe they're really getting a good deal. Maybe the salesman wouldn't really have sold it to this price to anybody but his mother. In their hearts, they probably know it's not true, but maybe it is.
In Muntz's used car lot, a new genre of car advertising was born, and it spread like wildfire.
If you're looking for a better set of wheels,
I will stand upon my head to beat all deals.
To Cal Worthington in the 50s and 60s, and to electronics dealer Crazy Eddie in the 70s and 80s.
Crazy Eddie, his prices are insane!
And it goes on and on.
Those crazy folks at Airport Toyota are in the midst of a marathon of madness.
As for why others followed suit, some experts we talked to said it was an ego thing on the part of the car dealers, like people like to be local celebrities. But it may persist because it worked.
Does it?
Well, for months, he was reported to have sold over $70 million worth of cars in a single year.
Is that in present-day money or?
No, in 1940s money. In present-day money, it's like over half a billion dollars.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, that's really impressive.
Yeah, I mean, his margins were thin, but still, he sold a lot of cars. But Jamie, I'm curious about your take on this. I mean, you work in marketing. What do you think of Muntz's story?
I mean, he did something right, and it must be working if it's gone on since the 40s.
Yeah.
When it comes to pay a higher fee,
I can see how it might spiral, though. It goes through a few filters, it's passed along among the generations, and people just get out of control.
Come to Rat Lisa now! Turn the TV off! Come now to Rat Lisa! Our prices are insane!
You will see what they mean when they claim that he's on Benzedrine. Sell your car and you will get much more.
When does it end? When does the madness end?
Figaro!
Coming up, the mysterious world of vanity plates.
I also saw one time that said Aquapug.
The madness continues after the break. A little later, the highs and lows of our groundbreaking vanity plate survey.
The best one I think I've ever seen in my entire life.
It's coming up. But first, listener Elliot called.
Hello.
Hi, Elliot.
Hi, Flora. How are you?
With a question about the origin of vanity plates.
Yeah. So in general, I was kind of like, when did the whole thing start?
Okay. So Elliot, that's a good question.
Oh, good.
That's plate collector Jeff Menard.
I've collected license plates most of my life.
License plate collecting is a thing.
I used to have 5,000. Now I've got about 100.
5,000?
Yeah. Oh, there's guys with 10 times that.
That's a lot of plates to be having.
Yes. So how did vanity plates begin? Regular license plates are born in 1901 in New York. They're a way for the state to ID the owner of an automobile, a new invention at the time, and to generate money for road repair.
So the first plates were homemade ones?
Homemade out of what?
Anything. Leather, go to the livery stable, get house numbers, hang the little thing on the back of your car.
But the fun, crafty days of license plates only lasts a few years. Soon after, plates become standardized and states start manufacturing the plates themselves.
Okay. It's like, when did the whole thing start? Like, where someone's like, you know, I don't like my license plate number. I want to change this.
So in the 1930s, we get the proto vanity plate. Pennsylvania lets people request specific number letter combinations, but the options are limited. And then Connecticut has the idea to reward drivers with a clean driving record.
It was a special program. You had to earn your way into it.
And the reward was a license plate with just letters, no numbers.
They gave you letters because it was distinctive from all the numbers that were out there.
Which apparently was like very exciting to people.
Today it seems sort of like old-fashioned, but that's it was a very cool thing.
Soon after that, Connecticut's best drivers start requesting specific letters, like their initials.
And then they began to allow, into the 50s, they began to allow words. I've seen the word camp, C-A-M-P.
Then New Hampshire, the live free or die state, catches wind of this newfound freedom, and in the 50s becomes the first state where unsafe drivers and safe drivers alike could pay money to author their own plates. New Hampshire gives us the gift of vanity plates.
I actually would have thought it would have been later in the 60s or so.
Well, it does take a while for vanity plates to move across the country. They get to California by the 1970s, and Jeff says that's when vanity plates really take off, thanks to a celebrity endorser.
Ronald Reagan was the governor. They said, we're going to have this personalized plate program. Here, you can sign up and put your first choice, your second choice, and your third choice, because so many people are going to want the same plates.
It gets a bunch of media attention. Everyone wants a plate.
The first personalized plate issued in California was the word amigo.
Amigo, because Reagan thought it sounded friendly. And from there, vanity plate programs spread. As of 2007, Virginia is the state with the highest vanity plate penetration rate. Virginia's for lovers of vanity plates. Texas has the lowest penetration rate at less than 1%. So any questions so far?
Yeah, so how do they actually get past the state to approve that plate? For example, I think it was Georgia banned Coffeevee from when President Trump actually tried to make that statement, and they said, nope, you're not.
My favorite version of this story is the rejected plate ILVTOFU, which was ostensibly about tofu. It was a vegan PETA employee in Tennessee who wanted an I love tofu plate.
Oh.
But unfortunately, or maybe intentionally, it worked on another level. So yeah, each state has its own rules enforced by the DMV. But basically, it's no obscenities, no curse words or vulgar slang in any language, no racial slurs. The plates can't be offensive to any group of people in any way.
The state says you're not going to use our license plate for your message.
Do they have to have like fact checkers and like wordsmiths like go through it?
They have a committee, and it's often a kind of confidential who it is, but they have a committee that decides.
We spoke with a Virginia DMV employee who's on a screening committee, and she said that they review 500 to 600 vanity plates a day. And this is how it works at Virginia's DMV. They run the request through a computer program that cross-checks the plate against 30,000 objectionable listings. And they also run the plate name backwards to make sure it doesn't say anything offensive in a mirror. And if the plate passes that first test but still seems questionable, then the request gets handed off to a committee.
They ask a lot of linguists. If they see words or letters they don't understand, they'd say, you know, is this a word in your language? Because somebody that does know is going to complain and say, do you know what you allowed?
But as we all know, tasteless plates do slip through the cracks. And we asked you, listeners, to send us your best and worst vanity plate sightings. And you did.
Hey, I'm just calling
about your vanity plate question.
I've got some good ones here for you.
The worst vanity plate I've ever seen.
I have one, and I'm not sure whether it's the best or the worst. The fuck? I just thought that was really funny.
218 of you called as of 10:57 on April 13th. Thank you. And I want to report back the findings of this extremely rigorous survey. Here's what we learned. In terms of content, nearly 20% of you reported plates of a sexual nature.
A man and a woman passed me, both riding their own Harley-Davidson motorcycles. So her said IB6 and his said IB9.
I'll let you do the math there. 13% of respondents reported plates that fell into the category of obscure nerd puns. Well represented were Magic the Gathering, Star Trek, and high school chemistry in jokes.
My favorite one that I've seen is on a cube car.
Like a Nissan Cube.
It was C6H1206, which, as you know, is the molecular formula for sugar. So it was a sugar cube.
You also reported a sizable number of occupation-related plates, dental themes,
Dr. Tooth,
anesthesiology references,
knock them out, which is what my mom does for a living,
and even a not-so-covert operation.
I noticed his license plate, and it said, I spy for U.S. And I thought, okay, worst spy ever.
So those were the big content trends. I also want to note that we had multiple callers describing dads using vanity plates to embarrass their children.
He shows up with a vanity plate that literally says I-C-K-Y-P-U-U. Icky poo. We thought he'd lost his mind.
And finally, a utilitarian plate.
Back in the day, a college friend of mine named Harry had N-O-N-E, as in none. So Harry was able to park anywhere he wanted. And when a cop filled out the ticket in the space that was for license plate, they wrote N-O-N-E. Free parking!
Yeah, that's brilliant.
The caller says Harry went on to be an assistant district attorney, by the way. Thanks, Elliot. And thanks to everyone who called with your license plate stories. We've loved getting them. And if you have a question or if you're suffering from a factual emergency, give the ELT helpline a ring, 347-464-9626. No question will be turned away. We want to hear from you.
Every Little Thing was produced by Zakiya Gibbons, Aaron Reese, Flora Lichtman, Annette Heist, Phoebe Flanagan, and Catherine Wells, with help from Nicole Pasulka and Doug Barron. Ian Chillug is our consulting editor. Dara Hirsch scored and mixed this episode. Look for ELT Show on Twitter and Facebook. Look for me on the road. I am a QT. Goodbye.